Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When you hear TV or movies, you hear script writers. Here's NBC's Heroes last week.
Okay, good. What's the apartment number?
He knows I'm here. He's coming.
Okay, Molly, what's the apartment number? Quickly, come on.
9.
All right, get out of there right now.
He sees me. Leave it alone!
Molly, get out of there.
Leave it alone!
Molly!
Heaven help us all, America's giant TV and movie entertainment industry is built on words. Words written by 12,000 working screenwriters across the country. Now, those writers are threatening to strike, and soon, if the studios and networks don't cut them in on internet revenues to come. As early as next week, you could be stuck with reruns and soon more script-free reality TV than you can stand. This hour On Point, the digital future hits Tinseltown, explosive changes coming in what and how we watch, and Hollywood has no idea how to divvy up the spoils. Joining me first today from Los Angeles is Carl DiIorio. He is deputy film editor and labor editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Carl, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. So we've got a standoff between producers and screenwriters, and what, end of the month is a strike possibility? They voted last week to say to give the union a green light. The writers did, to strike if they choose?
They did. The contract for the writers runs through October 31st. And they recently, as you said, Tom, voted to authorize leadership at the Writers Guild of America to strike if and when they believe it would be strategically beneficial. I have to tell you, there's many that suggest that time is not November 1st, but we shall see.
It's been a long time since a writer's strike, 1988, and video was the issue then. Now we read, Carl, that it's the internet and digital media and everything that means at the heart of it. How do you describe the crux of the conflict here?
I think two things bear on it, Tom. One is, much as you suggest, the onset of new media as a distribution platform, the internet, mobile entertainment of various sorts, oftentimes will have content that originated as a film and TV project. And writers are used to getting extra, what they call residuals, whenever film or TV projects play over ancillary platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet, they say, should be no different. And there's two different perspectives on that, the studios and theirs, as there are with all things. But this comes against the backdrop of history, where DVD came along.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a residual formula for how the union writers are paid when movies hit DVD. Bottom line, they believe they got the shaft back when that was worked out. And they say, fooled once, second time wise.
Mm-hmm.
But the studios, on the other hand, say, no, this is entirely different. Our TV business model is cratering. The internet's just going to help us tread water with respect to our own profitability, and we just can't afford to pay you yet. We have to see how some of these emerging business models play out. Give us a couple years to work this out. We'll study the issue.
Nobody knows what's going to happen, so the producers, the industry, doesn't want to promise a certain cut. If they go to a strike, and it was 90% for the authorization, for the green light to do that, if that's where they're headed, if that happens, how would the consequences fold out for American TV viewers and moviegoers, Carl?
Well, if the writers were to walk rather immediately, it's likely that the networks would let the current seasons, half seasons, if you will, of their hit TV shows play out, because those episodes are already scripted and many of them in the can.
Yeah.
Similarly, with the movie schedules, what you will see for the next few months will be the same whether there's a strike or not. But thereafter, all bets are off. With respect to television, it's widely assumed that what will happen is all of a sudden you'll see TV programs just filled with reality shows, the kind of relatively unscripted programming that has become a hit in recent years in selected portions of the programming grid.
Right.
But you'll see reality television 24/7.
if the strike comes, you ain't seen nothing yet on the reality front.
Exactly.
And what about the shows that come on basically that are written every day, whether it's Letterman or the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Leno, and all the rest? I mean, last time I was looking back, it was funny, Letterman cut his top 10 list down to the top 2 and said, "We have nothing to do, the writers aren't here, so a guy's going to come in and shave me, ladies and gentlemen, 55 minutes of shaving me."
Yeah, there are shows like that that will make do even in the absence of writers, and I think the late night shows tend to have a little bit of fun with it. Frankly, their hearts with the writers whom they work very closely with. But if you're talking about a show such as Heroes, as you started at the program, mm-hmm. With that little portion of, they'll just basically go away for the second half of the season if there's a protracted strike. The studios say, hey, if you walk out, you're gone till June, because June is when the actors and the directors have their contract expire. And the studios say, we'll just shift our attention to the actors and directors. They're more powerful, more important than you guys anyway, and go walk the picket lines if you want, but it's going to be a long strike, and you should know that.
And on the movie front, Carl, I'm reading here that sort of B and C tier films might come out of cans where they were stuffed imagining to go straight to DVD, but they might move into cinemas if the strike goes on.
Well, yes, there's some movies that are supposedly scripted for, let's say, next summer, and summer, of course, comes early in Hollywood.
Yep.
But Justice League of America, various other high-profile projects that the studios very much want to keep on track may come unhinged, the writers would tell you, because it's part and parcel of movie production that you really do need the writers on the set with you for scene rewrites and that kind of thing. Not to mention the fact that it's intimated that with respect to one or more of these high-profile movies, they really don't even have a final script approved yet. But, there's yet one more element here that we might mention.
Yes.
I mentioned in passing the directors. The Directors Guild of America have a history of starting their negotiations very early, much earlier than, in this case, the June 30th expiration date of their current contract. So one scenario that many believe will prevent a strike from actually happening, or if one does break out, shortening the length of any writer's strike, would see the directors start negotiations perhaps as early as next month. So you would have the writer's contract expiring on October 31st. By mid-November, late November, you'd have some early talks with the directors starting, who tend to bang out a contract within a month's time, such that writer strike or no writer strike, by, let's say, mid-December, Christmas, you could have a director's contract that effectively sets the scene for the writers and the actors having to follow suit with whatever sort of terms they hammer out.
So a couple of big options here, but no clarity really about where web entertainment is going and where the money may go with that. Carl DiIorio, you set the table for us wonderfully, and we're grateful for it. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Carl DiIorio with The Hollywood Reporter. Late-night talk shows might be the very first to feel the pinch if there's a writer's strike, because their teams of writers are churning out jokes and intros on the same day of show. Here's Letterman last week with his top 10 list, or a bit of it, on reasons why Joe Torre quit.
Number 3, $5 million a year. How is a man supposed to live? And number 2 doesn't want to be working when he's 90, like Letterman. Hey, what? Huh? And the number 1 reason Joe Torre quit, even Yogi Berra told him, it's over. There.
Writers made it happen. If they walk off, well, it'll be something different. Joining us right now from New York is Michael Winship. He's president of the Writers Guild of America East, a longtime producer and writer, long list of credits in commercial and public television. Michael Winship, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Is the strike threat real?
Of course it's real. But I'm not being disingenuous if I tell you I don't know at this point what's going to happen. We are prepared to talk as long as the producers at the networks and studios are willing to bargain off our proposals. And we will, you know, as Churchill said, better jaw-jaw than war-war.
Right. What do you want from the industry, Michael? They're saying, we don't know what to promise you or how to promise you. We don't know what the web is going to mean. How can we guarantee you X, Y, or Z?
It's very, very simple. We're saying, if you get paid, we get paid. So we're asking for a revenue-based system that is technology neutral and that's incredibly flexible.
Why don't they see it as that simple?
Well, because they want to keep as much of it as they can. And we feel that we need to get a fair shake.
I mean, so you think it's simply just guarantee us we get a piece of it and that they're trying to use a technology change to sort of cut you out of a piece of the action?
Yeah. I mean, as I've been saying consistently, we won't be fooled again. We got sort of jimmied around on the home video front, and we're not prepared to let that happen again. I mean, even in things like DVD, Carl mentioned DVD, although we're very, very concerned with new technology, we're also still concerned about DVDs. We currently make on a $15 DVD, yeah, we make about 4 cents, which is less than the guys who make the jewel box that holds it. Make. So we're asking for a doubling of that from 4 cents to 8 cents.
We're talking this hour about Hollywood writers threatening a big strike as movies and TV face the unknown of internet distribution. It could happen as early as the end of this month, and then, well, the knock-on effect right on through the end of the year and beyond. We've been joined by Michael Winship, president of the Writers Guild of America East, and we'll hear from much more from the West Coast as well. But let's get a call first from Dave in New York. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you know?
Well, I think what we're going through right now is a Euripidean shift.
Euripidean? You got us in ancient Greece, Dave. What?
Yes, I've got us in ancient Greece because I think, you know, our culture mimics ancient Greece in many ways, in its best ways, I should say, of our culture. And the chorus in Euripides' plays, he was the third great tragedian after Thoas and Sophocles, and he made the innovation of increasing the number of the chorus exponentially.
So who's in the chorus now? Where are you taking us, Dave?
Well, what I'm saying is I think that, you know, Euripides wrote during the decline of the Greek Empire, and during the decline, many more people had access to the hallowed ground of the tragedy stage. And I think that's what we're going through. I think that many more people today have access to our culture, to expressing our culture. I think the writers are being shut out by the people's voices. The people's voices are more powerful, more important.
So you mean a million people putting YouTube clips up of sort of funny home videos?
Exactly. And in Euripides' plays, the chorus took up half of the time as opposed to a tenth of the time. And the chorus was made up of 50 people as opposed to 10 people.
Dave, we've got it. Let's put it to the writer's rep. Michael Winship, how about it? Is this what you talk about in the writer's clubhouse, whether, you know, YouTube and the great unwashed public is going to be putting up all their own material and you guys are, I don't know, unnecessary?
Well, first, let me say I'm a big fan of that blog that Euripides has. I think it's terrific.
And
I'm
still going strong.
I enjoy reading it every day. He's amazing. He's very prolific, that guy. The thing about the new technology, or advanced technology, as my colleague Shelley calls it, is that we don't know where it's going. We don't know. I mean, we're not sure. I mean, when Edison invented the phonograph, he invented it as a dictation system. Mm. And when we started playing music on the phonograph, it actually was invented as a promotional tool for sheet music sales. So we just don't know what's happening. That's why we're so very adamant about this revenue-based proposal, because no matter what the media is, no matter what the technology is, we still get a piece of the revenue.
But Dave is in New York is painting a picture that's not so promising for you or the sort of big shots of industry, saying, you know, the people are going to put up their own material, millions of funny ad libs from kids sitting in the, I don't know, the basement, and
still comes down to creativity and talent, and it still comes.
But they
down
put it up for free, those kids. On YouTube, it's all, you know, I mean, do we still need writers if we've got everybody posting to the web?
It's, you know, if it's not on the page, it ain't on the stage, as they say. And, you know, the talented writers, the writers who are part of our union, there's always going to be a demand for their creativity and their storytelling abilities.
You mentioned Shelley. Let's bring in Shelley Palmer, an expert on the changing business and technology of television, been a writer and producer. He's now president of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences in New York, the organization that gives the Emmy Awards and oversees the Advanced Media Technology Emmy Awards. Shelley Palmer, thanks for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Give us a sense of what's going on here. Everybody's fighting over a future that nobody can define exactly. Number one, do you think the writers are going on strike? And number two, whether or not they do, where are we headed?
Well, I'm unqualified to tell you whether they're going to go on strike or not, but I can tell you for the first time in a long time, both sides are equally right. The writers absolutely can't give any ground with respect to this, and we'll talk about what they might be able to ask for in a second.
Okay.
And the producers really can't give any ground here because they truly do not know what the future will bring. With respect to the writers, they're asking for a revenue share.
Right.
And a revenue share is a great idea. And in fact, it's the only possible way you can look at the future.
We don't know what the revenue will be, so we'll share it.
No. Well, it's not even that. The question is, everybody involved in a creative process is part, it's that horrifying word synergy. Everyone is part of making the whole greater.
Okay.
The director, the singers, the actors, the lighting director, the costume designer, the makeup artist. Every single person in my constituency at the Emmy Awards and at the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, including writers, we have many writer members,
yep,
they all contribute with their heart and soul to making a project something wonderful, something better and greater that they can be super proud of. And we take obviously the best of those and we try to honor them a couple times a year. But ultimately, what percentage is the makeup artist entitled to? What percentage is the guy that's stringing the cables entitled to? The electrician, the craft services person who makes it all possible? Because trust me, if you've ever been on an actual set of a TV or film production,
sure,
the craft services person may be the singularly most important person on the set. What percentage are they entitled to?
So a lot of hands in the pot, but it's writers we're talking about today. And if it's so obvious that they're entitled to something, why wouldn't producers, the industry, just say so? Okay, you can have X percent, whatever it is, that we'll guarantee you that. Why not?
Well, I don't think I can speak for the industry as a whole, but I can tell you that it's really difficult to quantify. And once you agree, then you're just negotiating on the number. That opens up a can of worms that any negotiator will tell you they probably rather not be have opened. And as far as the future is concerned, you know, just to get back to your caller a minute ago,
yeah,
Euripides not with
and the Greek chorus of YouTube, yeah.
But here's the problem. You said that why wouldn't we just be looking at all this stuff that people put up? To be honest, only 1% of what goes up on YouTube is originally created. Everything else is shared. It's stuff you've taken that already exists, and you may have put your own mark on it. You may have mashed it up with something else. You may have edited out the commercials. You may have somehow tweaked it.
Mm-hmm.
But most of what you see on YouTube is professionally produced content that's shared. And in fact, YouTube is famous or became very popular for two things that are really interesting. One is the social network aspect of YouTube, which allows people to very easily share files with one another.
Sure.
So that they can wear their files like they wear their beer, like they wear their clothes, like they wear their car. They can just say, hey, I'm associated with this piece of Jon Stewart content, or I'm affiliated with this piece of South Park content. And the other thing that YouTube does is it allows us to snack. We video snack now. A little 2-minute video snack or a 30-second video snack that
right.
You get emailed from a friend who goes, oh, and it's really funny. During the business day, you take a short break to your boss's chagrin and you watch a little video snack. I don't see how that replaces going to the movies or watching television or watching the news at 6 o'clock at night. It's not a replacement. It's an add-on. It's a wonderful new add-on, and it's a new art form, but it's certainly not a replacement for the things that already exist.
Mm. Shelley, Michael, let me get a call from L.A. We've got Stan on the line. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm also a member of the Writers Guild West, and I don't know if Michael has made this point, but I think it's important for listeners to know that the digital download is the future, which is what makes this contract so important. That as the computer and television converge, my daughter, who goes to Tufts, I should add, doesn't wait and watch Lost on Wednesday at 9. She downloads it and she watches it whenever she has time. And that's why it's so important that writers get a fair compensation for the use and reuse of their work, because in the next 5 or 10 years, it's going to be the sole use.
But Stan, you know, the numbers now are pretty puny. I'm looking here. They say 20 million annually from all the different ways movies are downloaded. That's all right now. And only 100 million in, ad revenue to major networks compared to 22 billion on network TV in 06. I mean, it looks like peanuts.
Well, I think there was a time, you know, the last time we went out on strike, in fact, there were only a few thousand VHS cassettes being sold at $60 each.
Yeah.
And the contract that was put into place then compensated writers, I think, at something like 1.2% of 20%, because the studios argued, well, here's a $60 cassette. It costs $40 to make, another $10 to distribute and manufacture. And that formula has stayed in place for the next 20 years. And as you know, millions upon millions of VHS cassettes have been sold, as well as DVDs.
Mm-hmm. And Stan, are you ready to go out on strike, Stan, if that's the call?
Well, I did vote yes for the strike authorization because I feel that this is so important, not so much for me as it is for the next generation of writers who are coming up.
And they're coming up fast. Stan, thanks very much for that. Let me get one more.
Hey,
from
Tom.
Oh, yeah, who's that, Michael, Shelley?
Shelley, a comment on that real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think people should not get caught up today in the idea that the quality on YouTube is really small, or that you have to watch things from YouTube in your email or at your computer leaning forward. Just close your eyes and imagine that the quality was identical to the best quality picture you've seen and ubiquitously available.
And you're saying it will be.
It has no choice. If you look at your phone bill from 10 years ago, $40 got you 40 minutes. Mm. Today, $40 gets you 4,000 minutes or more, right? It won't take 10 years for you to have absolutely unlimited bandwidth coming from your providers. That wireless capacity will allow us in handhelds to have incredibly high quality pictures in everywhere. So if now instead of qualifying and saying, oh, digital download, just say I have an open network and a closed network, and I now have the ability to get what I want, really, what I want, when I want, where I want. And if you're negotiating today a contract that's more than a minute long, you have to pretend that this stuff is just available at superiorly high quality, and then let the chips fall where they may.
And Tom, this is Michael. I'm not quite sure about where you're getting your numbers, but I know that Price Waterhouse, for example, estimates that the download sales and rentals, will be at about $1 billion by 2011, and the video streaming revenues will be around $3 billion by 2010. So it's a lot of money.
That's a big piece of pie out there. Let me get a call from Carrie Ann in Framingham, Massachusetts. Carrie Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I wanted to say that I am absolutely in support that the writers should definitely get some money from webcasts, but I think it is very difficult for them to get residuals as they do from DVDs.
Why?
Because I think it's harder to monitor. I think it's easier to steal, and I think that they might get a better deal if they took a cut off the top. And I also just want to say, I think a caller said that, you know, everybody's putting things on YouTube, and should everybody get paid from the guy who's doing it to his living room?
Or nobody.
Or nobody, right.
Yep.
But I think that the people who do put things, do things in their living room or whatever, are emerging artists who maybe if they get enough hits off YouTube, maybe they'll get a writer's contract. And I think that, I mean, writers should get the money, and emerging authors and writers can use this to make their own money.
Carrie Ann, it sounds like you're pretty well plugged in. Michael Winship, I don't know the lingo well enough here. Off the top instead of residuals, how do you read
that? Well, that means the payment for the original
one time, here you go, and thank you very much.
Yeah, and what we're saying is that every time you make money, we get money. So that every time they get paid, we get paid.
Is it
Tom? This is the issue, Shelley. The issue is windowing. Because you had technology that locked in what's called a form factor. A DVD can be played on a DVD player. A VHS tape can be played. So you call that the home video group. Then you have the airline distribution. You have foreign rights. You have cable rights. Every time that a producer has an opportunity to monetize or make money. In the past, there have been many defensible form factors. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put it out on broadcast network television first run. Then it's going to go to reruns. Now it's going to be syndicated to local television stations. All of a sudden, we've got some consumer control, and all anybody on the writer side is asking for – and by the way, every guild's going to ask for this. This is not unique to the writers, and so you can might as well just fill in the blank because every union and every guild's going to jump on this.
We're all working together.
Yeah, the windowing thing is coming to an end. Not the closed distribution windows of airlines and foreign, but when you put something out on the internet, it's out there. And so when you make money, and the question whether you're going to make money or not even shouldn't be on the table, because advanced media sales are in question. So much stuff is illegally downloaded and shared and traded. Like, you know, you can't even put that on the table. But when you make money, everybody's asking for a little share of it. And that's not the most unreasonable thing ever. The question that the caller just brought up that's really important is exactly how are you going to monitor that? Because it's really, really tough.
We've got a lot of new material on the table here, mashups and wee-wee-wee and form factors. Wow. Let me bring in another voice here from Washington. Jonathan Potter joins us, Executive Director of the Digital Media Association. Its members include technology companies like Microsoft, AOL, Apple, Real Networks, YouTube. Represents the emerging internet distribution end of the entertainment industry. Jonathan Potter, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So do you see a problem here with just guaranteeing everybody who's involved in creating a piece of the revenue when it comes down the pike?
Clearly, creators have to be paid. And we're not sitting at this table because we're not sitting at the negotiation table, obviously. Our companies are distributing. In some instances, we might become or be primary distributors of web content or content that was developed for the web, content that is developed for the mobile phone. But oftentimes we're secondary distributors or tertiary distributors, as things go up in various ways.
And so what are you whispering to the industry then, Jonathan? Are you saying, go ahead, do the contract, give them a piece, why not?
I think if we're whispering anything to the industry, and we are doing outreach on all sides of this discussion, it is to maintain flexibility in the distribution mechanism and maintain flexibility in the way that accounting is done to make sure that we don't shut things off or, in fact, inhibit the enormous opportunity that has to exist.
That sounds like you may be against the ironclad guarantee of a piece that Michael Winship wants in there.
Oh, we're not getting into the economic debate at all, frankly. Our concern is, for instance, let me give you one example.
Yeah.
Several years ago, AFTRA, which represents, I believe, and the others can correct me, I believe represents television and recording artists, did a radio advertisements contract with the radio industry, the broadcast radio industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that contract required that if a radio advertisement was repurposed to the internet, rebroadcast over the internet, the residual would be 3x whatever it had been for the traditional broadcast.
Okay.
And I think the thinking at the time was, if you put it out over the internet, you're putting it out to a worldwide audience. It's an enormous audience.
Yep.
And so there should be a 3x residual.
Mm-hmm.
What that did was it killed the radio rebroadcast advertising industry. Because, in fact, radio rebroadcasting over the internet didn't necessarily mean that anybody was listening, didn't mean that 5 people or 500 people or 5 million people were listening, but it, in fact, was a way that people raised money to create a technology to strip out radio ads. So that hurt the AFTRA members, it hurt the broadcasters, it helped a quirky technology of stripping out ads and replacing them with internet-only ads. And what we want to do is make sure that nobody sticks a round peg into a square hole and creates inflexibility in the business model.
Mike's calling from Boston. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in the conversation that everyone is having today, and I just wanted to bring up a quick point. I really think that the Writers Guild and all the other entertainment guilds and the studios are kind of arguing about the wrong thing. I really think there needs to be a fundamental reevaluation of the way entertainment is financed, because the bottom line is, as of today, I mean, right now, you can immediately get any piece of entertainment on any medium that's as soon as it's released, it's immediately available all around the world for free to anyone who wants it. I'm a bit of a geek. I'm a very proud internet pirate, and I download everything I watch via the news groups, which is kind of the seedy underbelly of the internet. And I have to say, there's very little incentive for me to even watch TV anymore or go to the movies because everything is available so quickly.
But you're saying you're a pirate because you don't want to pay to play. You get everything for free. That doesn't sound like too promising for residuals or for revenue sharing. You're not paying.
I don't think residuals or revenue sharing should be even part of the conversation anymore. I think the old model of like TV shows in the 1950s where you had a signal sponsor that would finance a show and maybe would have advertising throughout the show, or instead of the network bug, you have the Nike swoosh or something to that effect, because I just don't think that this type of conversation is going to be very productive. I mean, George Lucas right now is producing a couple of TV shows. He's going to do it kind of backwards. He's going to produce everything completed up front, the 100 episodes of his show, and then shop it around to whoever wants it, and he'll make his money back.
Mike, stick with us. Michael Winship, here's your worst nightmare, the online pirate who says, I'm not going to pay, so whatever you want, you better get off the top. Forget about residuals or, you know, revenue sharing downstream. It's not going to be there.
You're under arrest.
And after that, the other 4 million behind him? I mean, what about it?
Well, no, I mean, there's no question that these are problems that have to be worked out. And there's no, you know, these are some of the issues that we're facing. This is a brave new world, and we're all in it together.
Tom, this is Shelley.
The
way this works is those with more time than money steal, those with more money than time pay. And that's pretty much, you know, America pays for convenience. They've demonstrated that they will pay for convenience. They also pay for programming and packaging. You know, you can be your own program director if you want to watch on demand, but there's something magical about somebody actually understanding a form of entertainment, whether it's radio or television or the movies, and programming an emotionally satisfying evening for you, whether it's a few hours or a few minutes. And that's a value, and you will pay for the value. Now, will all the show creators be equally compensated in the future as they are today? Will the pool of money be as large? You know, we could argue for hours about downloading versus not downloading a distribution system. And really, it's a different show. This show is a pretty simple show. There is a finite pool of money right now that's understood, and there's a little more money available out there should you be successful. And the question is, what's everyone entitled to? It's a pretty simple question, and it you don't need to get into the future of the world or the future of technology to understand that things are going to change. Like, no matter what we think about today, no matter what suggestions brought up on this phone call, there'll be new suggestions tomorrow.
But Mike may be a pirate, and Michael Winship may want to slam him in the dungeon, but he sounds like a pretty smart guy, and he's saying, you know, you need a new model here. Because
that's entirely possible. The thing is, though, that the 50s analogy doesn't work for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is that a lot of the writers during the 50s owned their copyright, which they do not now in television and screen.
Right.
And that's why we have the residual system.
Jonathan Potter, can you see a time where pirates like our caller Mike are not able to scarf up whatever they want for free? That would change the conversation. Or is that a permanent part of the internet era?
I think that piracy is not going away. I think Shelley was correct in his comment that as you get more money and less time, you go out and have children, you have a job that keeps you busy 10, 12, 14 hours a day. It's a lot harder to be your own programming filter and go on YouTube or go on a Usenet group and find everything you want in the quality that you want. And a lot of it has to do with the quality. If I know I'm guaranteed to go on iTunes and get the episode of Lost downloaded for $1.99 and be able to watch it when I get on the airplane, that's worth $1.99, as opposed to going to a Usenet group and getting it and getting on that airplane where I'm out of touch, and all of a sudden I find the thing blinks out after 5 minutes and I'm toast. I'm stuck with, you know, the airline movie.
Right. So there's confidence that there will be a pie to slice up.
Oh, there will always be a pie to slice up. It's a question of getting music and getting media to people as they want it, as they're willing to pay for it, and in ways that are able to generate revenue. I think what was interesting about our caller from Boston, I think it was from Boston, is that he didn't say, you know, I don't want people to get paid. What he said is, I'm not interested in going to my TV, turning it on at 7 p.m. and watching, you know, as it's presented by the network. He said, I want it the way I want it, when I want it. I'm not willing to pay a subscription fee. Therefore, I want it. Therefore, if the world shifts to an on-demand for free world, then we are going to have to go back to Ronald Reagan and GE Presents.
Yeah, our caller Mike is still with us. Pirate Mike, what do you say about the pushback there?
Well, I think they're all valid points, and I think the last commenter there was pretty much spot on. I will say the news groups, the Usenets are not free, and I know that's getting a little bit technical for a lot of people out there. You do have to pay an access fee in addition to your regular internet service provider to be able to access them in any meaningful way. What I would say is the idea of having a network package, you know, programming and present you, the viewer, with a kind of a plate of here's some entertainment, please take it from us and enjoy it.
Yeah.
That is something that's going to be around forever. I just think that that's only going to be one part of the discussion, and I really think that the whole paradigm of how people get paid for producing entertainment needs to change. That's a part, but it really can't be the focus, and otherwise it's just really a waste of time.
There goes the pirate with his Jolly Roger and his view, and it may be a big piece of the future. Mike, thanks for calling. Let's get one from Melville, New York. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And really enjoy your programs, and you're a great host.
Thank you.
The question I want to ask is: there's 12,000 members of this group.
Yes, sir.
How much does the average make? You know, what is their average take-home pay for the year? That's number one.
Okay.
And number two: who really takes the risk on producing all of these things? And aren't they entitled to the great share of the money received?
Charles, stick with us for a second. Michael Winship, who gets what? Is it all Gucci loafers and Ferraris in your Writers Guild world?
I think that's one of the great stereotypical images, which is really not true. And I think
you guys wrote it into all the scripts. I mean, we see those. You know.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's, you know, it's the curse of Dallas Dynasty.
They're all riding over Malibu Beach. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you know, and the fact of the matter is that it's really quite. A lot of it is a middle-class profession, and that a lot of our memberships at any given time are not, you know, working full-time. In fact, about half of our membership, the median income on guild work is about $5,000.
Wow. So residuals matter to get something off what
yeah,
they did.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Residuals are what keep people going between great jobs. I mean, the classic example of this is the guy who created Desperate Housewives, who originally, you know, worked on Golden Girls, did well on Golden Girls, and then didn't really work on anything until Desperate Housewives. And what kept him going, besides some odd jobs and some part-time work,
yep.
were the residuals from Golden Girls.
So the other question that Charles raises is, you know, who puts the money up here, and how do they factor it? I mean, there's the industry piece of this. And the industry has been saying to you, we don't want to agree to anything right now because we don't know what's going to happen. Let's study this for a couple of years and then figure it out. Why not?
Well, first of all, just simply, we're the price of doing business. But secondly, they do know. I mean, they do know. I mean, it's an evolving thing. It's going to change every day. It's going to change every hour. But the fact remains, they've been doing this for a number of years. There are thousands of contracts between the networks and studios and new media. It's not something that they're totally blind about.
Charles in New York, thanks for calling. Let's get one from Newton, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I've worked for many years in the industry, and the two points I would like to make is that the difference in the business right now is that the business is totally controlled by stars, not just movie stars, but star writers, star directors. And it's interesting when the advocates of kind of free content and the pirates say, oh, I can get whatever I want for free. Well, the fact of the matter is somebody has to make these programs, and they wouldn't know about them if they weren't interested in them because of the level of work that goes into them. And I think part of the reason we're in the situation we're in right now is because the business has had its salaries driven up, its star salaries driven up by agents and managers, and essentially the business is controlled by the agents. The dichotomy is that the vertically integrated companies now own the content as well as distribute it, and that's one of the reasons we're in the predicament we're in now.
But Sam, where are you going with that? If it's star-driven, that sounds stars sound like highly paid people. That may lead our pirate Mike to say, why shouldn't I rip it off if they're making so much money?
Well, what I'm saying is essentially there has not yet been an instance of someone, you know, who gets their break through YouTube all of a sudden becoming this huge star. So I think people can't get it both ways. I think the ignoring of craft, of the craft that goes into becoming a popular actor, becoming a successful writer or director, is something that people in general don't understand, that these are crafts, and people have to work a long time to get to the point of where they are well paid. I think the danger.
Tom, this is Shelley.
Stick with us, Sam.
Make it a really good point, mm-hmm. but I want to say that it's not the issue we're describing. Although he's brought up a really important, really specter of the future, and it can actually be very simply stated: in the past, meaning any time before last year, you could just pick any time in the year. The studios could defend on a closed network system. You don't get anything over your cable system that the cabler doesn't send to you. Mm-hmm. You don't get anything over satellite that the satellite system doesn't send to you.
There were boundaries. They knew them. We all knew them. Yep.
Right. And now we're talking about an open network. And the question is, how do you defend financially creative product that is a file on an open network? And I got to tell you, that is a big, big issue. And the dollars involved in something that can be distributed in an open network where it is instantly free are really in question. You can't make a $13 million episode of a dramatic TV hour if you can't get $26 million back for it.
Shelley,
you simply can't make it.
But it sounds like there you're sympathetic to the industry bosses who are saying, we can't guarantee you something here. We don't know what we're going to get.
I am sympathetic to the fact that this, like I said when I opened up my opening statement, is this is one of the very, very few times where both sides are absolutely right, and it all depends on what side of the river you're on. And by the way, both Michael and I are writer-producers and, owners of production companies. I mean, you sit there and say, I need to produce something. I have an economic model. You put your other hat on and say, well, now I'm writing it. I need to pay myself. I'm going to act in it. I need to pay myself. Wow. These are very, very difficult issues. And you know what? There are very smart guys who are going to hammer each other to death over this over the next couple of days.
Caller Sam, who do you think gets hammered here, the star or, the craftsman who's down in the big army of people making these shows happen if it doesn't get worked out right?
Well, my belief is the craftsman has been hammered repeatedly over the last few years, and I would even say that it's not random. I'd say it's virtually a conspiracy on the part of the vertically integrated companies to minimize talent. The fact of the matter is that until the middle 90s or middle to late 90s, the networks did not own their own programming. And also until very recently, the Nielsen ratings were something that everyone bought into.
Right.
So the point is there was an illusion that X number of people were watching. Well, we really don't know how many people are watching.
Because it's all over. The web is everywhere. Sam, our time is short, but we appreciate your call. I want to get one more. Carl from Boston. Carl, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I work in software development, and we develop obviously lots of products and things like that, but the creative software programmers don't get paid commission on products that typically are sold. And I was wondering if this problem continues for the writers, will their work get outsourced to India also?
Right. You're in software, and you'd love to get a residual or some downstream guarantee, but in that technology, you don't. Jonathan Potter, is it going to be different for the creative types on Malibu?
I don't expect network television or highly popular television to be outsourced to Bangalore for the writing of it. But I do agree a lot with what Shelley said. This is a time right now where there's a reason why we call it risk capital. Producers are investors, and that doesn't mean that the big studio producers. It means everybody. And so when Shelley is producing or when Michael is producing in their own product, this is a time where capital is really at risk because we don't know what the returns are, either off the network, off the web, off the cell phone. And so there's going to be some bloodbaths.
But is Microsoft, and you represent them in part, going to give special respect to a creative TV or film writer, or are they going to see them just like another software writer in a cubicle? Shut up and
Microsoft
will pay you.
Microsoft and all our companies are always favoring, licensed legal content. There's Microsoft just was part of an announcement with several of the studios or and network television folks over the last week, which you can find at ugcprinciples.com, which is all about how to create filtering technologies and copyright protection technologies so that legal content will prevail on the internet in the user-generated content world. I know YouTube is filtering content and trying to promote legal content at the expense of illegal content. There's going to be money. There's going to be revenue, but it's an enormously risky time for all producers, large and small. And that's why I think we're going to see some very big winners, but we're also going to see some very big losers over the next 5 or 10 years.
Michael Winship, last word goes to you. Are these guys that Jonathan represents, are they your friends looking forward, Microsoft and the whole technology side of this?
I think potentially, yes, absolutely. What I was going to say was that, that all these problems, all these issues, all these paradoxes are why we're fighting so hard this time. And it's why we're working so closely with our friends at SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and the Directors Guild, and all the other entertainment unions.
Well, it is a fluid world we live in. It'll be fascinating to see what unfolds here. It's great of each of you to be with us this hour. Shelley Palmer, author of Television Disrupted. Shelley, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jonathan Potter at Digital Media Association. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Michael Winship, president of the Writers Guild of America East. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.